To be back here with you again, and I want to suggest that there's probably three kinds of people in this room right now. I'm thinking some of you have come back to the Biblical Worldview Student Conference because of Miss Loveliness that you met last year, or Mr. Hunkmeister that you met last year, right? And you know, you want to think that you want to come for a week of learning for a lifetime, and maybe there's some of that, mixed motives, but that's why you came. Some of you came because your mom and dad had concerns, and they sort of coerced you. They said, if you go, we will let you, you know, whatever, after you get back. You can go see this or that or some other activity that you want to do. The third category, I hope, is the category that has to do with a theme verse for this conference, which I absolutely love. 1 Peter 3, I'll pick up in 14 and 15. How many of you know this is the theme verse for the conference? 1 Peter 3:15. It is now, okay? But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for the reason of the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and respect. Think about how different social media would be if we just, the last phrase of that, with gentleness and respect, if we engaged that way. The Bible covers all of this. There didn't have to be social media back there for this to be eminently relevant to how we engage in disagreements with one another. How we make a defense. We need to know things. That's what this conference is about. And we need to own those things so that we can articulate them. We need to go in the trivium. We need to go to the rhetoric stage, right? So we can actually be eloquent in the written word or in verbalizing and debate and discussion with others about these things. But did you notice that the whole purpose of this is that we are honoring the Lord, Christ the Lord, as holy? And that goes back to, I'm thinking of the American idols, I'm thinking of how we try to be blessed and happy, as we've heard already, by worldly things, as we pursue things that can't fill the God-sized hole in who we are as human beings made in the image of God. We want to put the honor on ourselves all too often, don't we? We just don't understand why everybody else isn't on board with that agenda, right? You know, why doesn't everybody else want to honor me as the one set apart, right? But this text tells us that our being able to give a defense, our being able to give an apologetic for the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ, is founded on our honoring Christ the Lord as holy. So that's my goal as we engage in these five addresses this week for me on C.S. Lewis. And I loved it when Debbie and Dell got in touch with me and said, you know, we'd like to have you come back and we'd like you to do something on C.S. Lewis. And I'm just like, oh, you know, it's only a week long, you know. I don't have every session throughout the day. There's so much material there. And so consequently, as I find too, I fired off, didn't I, Debbie? Like right away, fired off five suggestions. And then as I put those together, I refined them a little bit. So I'll make some suggestions about the changes of some of the topics and maybe some of the order of them too. And my apologies for that. But I think you'll be a beneficiary of that in the end. You know, I have two kids at home. I have four married, and my two kids at home are 12 and 15. And I wasn't sure if I could bring a 15-year-old, but I find out today at lunch that I could have. And so I wish Giles was here. I'd be giving him a hard time, you know. Giles, pay attention, I would say, you know. I like that, James. That was good. You know, my kids are homeschooled, but they're involved in all kinds of stuff, from ballet to choir to voice to track and field clubs and NJROTC and police explorers and all this stuff. I mean, we're shuttling. It's not just mom's taxi. It seems like we're, you know, shuttling different directions all the time. But they meet other kids, and, you know, they start talking, what does your dad do? you know? And, you know, they're talking to kids in our community, and they say, well, he's a machinist at the shipyard. You know, Puget Sound Naval Shipyard is a big employer in our county. Or he's a contractor, or he's a nuclear engineer at the shipyard, or he's a doctor, or he's a lawyer, or he's a kidney specialist, or something along those lines. And then they say, Giles, Jillian, what does your dad do? And they kind of, what was that? He does church history. And they don't really get what that is. It's kind of an awkward thing. You know, sometimes they say, Dad, why can't you just have a normal job, you know? But I am I'm passionate about church history, and I'm passionate about church history in a subordinate way. You know, I'm passionate about the Westminster Standards, but very much in a subordinate way to sola scriptura, right? I'm passionate about church history because I think the Bible is passionate about church history. Psalm 16:3, what does it say? The saints in the land, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. We're all going to have idols. We're all going to have heroes, legitimate heroes. And we have an unending supply of very legitimate heroes in our family history. And that's what I want for myself and for my family and for you, is to increasingly have a sense that this is your family. The heroes of church history, oh, they have feet of clay. There's no question about that. All of them do. That shouldn't remove them from the equation and from our consideration of them. But what are some of the things, very quickly here, what are some of the things that we gain before we launch into a specific figure in church history, which is C.S. Lewis? What are some of the things that we gain? Well, very quickly, the Bible, the New Testament alone, 28 different times tells us that we're to imitate others. We're to imitate Christ, first and last, but we're to imitate others who are following Christ and who are ministers of Christ and who are serving Him and worshiping Him and adoring Him with the gifts that they've been given. Church history gives us good models for imitation, wonderful models for imitation. I have several addresses that I do on the women of the Reformation. A remarkable women, horrible marriages. I mean, abysmal marriages. Because they were godly, earnest women, and they had arranged marriages in those days, and they were married off to monstrous haters of the Word of God, the five solas, and of the cause of the Reformation. Wonderful heroes lie all about us in our history. We learn discernment. We learn how to see with larger perspective. We get this enlargement of who we are. You know, one of the things that's such a problem for all of us, and for young people I think especially, but all of us, is that we're surrounded by tangible things. We're surrounded by phenomena that we can observe with our five senses. Empirical things surround us. And it's very easy for us to begin to think that that's the only thing that's real, are the empirical things. The things we can taste, touch, smell, handle, hear, all of that. And church history gives us a perspective, sort of a platform, really more a mountaintop, let's call it that, from which we can view now. And if we're caught up in the here and the now, we're going to have a very difficult time being informed critics, in a right sense of the word, of post-modernity that surrounds us. Or is it post-post-modernity now? Or is it post-post-post-modernity? I don't know. But in any case, they'll come up with new names for all this stuff. It's nothing new under the sun. It's various ways to try, and C.S. Lewis says this, that history is really a long story of people trying to find ways to be fulfilled apart from God. And that makes a lot of history a pretty ugly story. In the wars of the 20th century, for example. We can learn from the mistakes of the past. We can learn from the errors. You might say, well, why C.S. Lewis? You know, he had some real problems in some of his theology, and he did. You know, there's times when I'm so upset with C.S. Lewis. You know, Reflections on the Psalms, and he's saying things that make me think, wait a minute, that sounds contrary to what you said elsewhere about the authority of sola scriptura. You know, what do you mean? Well, part of that is that Lewis was a work in progress, and we'll talk a good deal about that in some other dimensions of these addresses this week. The church history provides us caution. It tells us that we don't need outside assassins in the church. If you study church history, you'll say, oh my goodness, we need to be very cautious about inside the church. You know, we pull the ripcord on ourselves from within. It's the premise of my book, Grace Works in Ways We Think It Doesn't. It's a historical study of how, in the church, we torpedo ourselves. We introduce, just incrementally, we would never come and say, you know, I think it would be a good idea if we just abandoned belief in the deity of Jesus Christ. You know, that doesn't happen like that. Or that we abandon justification by faith alone. The devil's much more clever than that. He's been doing this for millenniums. He's going to come in and he's just going to incrementally tweak it, just a little bit. And this was helpful for me. I consider myself someone who learns as they write and writes as they learn. You know, I'll write a book on, you know, my Fathers and Sons series. You know, and people say, oh, he's an expert on parenting, and I, oh, please don't say that. I'm daily in need of grace. I'm bungling, and I need reminders all the time to keep my eyes fixed on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, for myself, my own heart, and for my family. But I'm a learner, and this was a way that I learned about how in church history we do this all the time. So hopefully that is beneficial to you. This is Reformation Heritage has got this on their table. There, they have one fewer right at the moment here, but don't tell him. You know, it's okay, I'll get that back to you. All right. And then, so it gives us this caution. Well, why C.S. Lewis? Why C.S. Lewis? And I'm not going to answer that simply at the moment, but I would like to say that with all of C.S. Lewis's problems, and those areas of frustration. When I was a little kid, my parents didn't read C.S. Lewis to me. In fact, a lot of more fundamentalist American Christians didn't like this beer-swilling, you know, pipe-smoking Anglican over there across the pond writing fantasy stories that weren't true, you know. And we had lots of concerns about that in those days. And it's always good to be cautious. It's good to be concerned about those things. But C.S. Lewis, what he does get right, listen carefully here, what he does get right, he said probably better than just about anybody. And that's one of the things, that's one of the reasons why I've found so much inspiration in C.S. Lewis's writing, part of my job is taking people to C.S. Lewis places, you know, in my Oxford Creative Writing Masterclass and in church history tours in England and Scotland and so forth. And in France, I get home Saturday night and I leave Monday morning for the armistice tour. We'll be where C.S. Lewis was wounded in the Western Front and all of that. And that's all detailed in this book. Out there, War in the Wasteland, immersed myself in the horrors of World War I, the rich material in C.S. Lewis's canon. I wasn't sleeping well while I was writing that book, and I usually sleep like a baby. You know, wake up every 2 hours and cry. Right? No, not that kind of baby. But I usually do sleep really well without any assistance. You know, I don't, you know, except when I'm traveling, I'll take a sleep aid or something. And I was saying, man, I couldn't sleep last night. I was up at 3, you know, and my wife says, you were sitting in the living room in front of the fire for 2.5 hours reading memoirs, eyewitness memoirs of World War I, you know, some of the survivors of the Battle of the Somme. And all. Of course you can't sleep. It's amazing you got 3 hours of sleep last night. So she helps me a lot with things like that. Which I'm not able to see. I'm too close to it. Well, let's launch in and look at an overview of C.S. Lewis's life for the time that we have in this first address. And we're finished at 1:45, right? Sharp. So you can unplug me at that time. Clive Staples Lewis. You wonder who would name their kid Clive Staples. C.S. Lewis wondered why they named him Clive Staples. He hated the name Clive Staples. What does it even mean, you know? But he was born in Belfast, Ireland, November 29th, 1898, so just at the tail end of that 19th century, lots of changes were afoot. Modernism was the order of the day. I'll talk more about that tomorrow as it leads us into the horrors of World War I. The failure of turning your back on God in whatever you call it, but in that day it was modernism. Well, that surrounded C.S. Lewis. There were big changes afoot in literature and in poetry and in education. And all of these things would, C.S. Lewis would be positioned on the chronology of the timeline of history to be able to critique and expose, and he does it brilliantly. Again, where he gets it right, his critique of modern education, for example, and abolition of man. What he gets right in there is said better than anybody about the problem. And he foresees where we're going to be now on social issues and on if we remove the organ, we're going to we're not going to be able to be aghast when we have cowards in our midst. And he's going to be so perceptive on so many of these areas. Well, let's go back to Bouncing Baby Boy in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And we think of Lewis, if somebody asks you, and maybe you have a superficial understanding of Lewis's history, you would think of him as always an English writer, right? And in fact, he really is considered to be an English writer. There are Irish writers. Dr. Stewart could tell us all about them, I'm sure, and quote them in dialect, but Lewis was not included among them. He would be ranked as an English writer, and that kind of would bother C.S. Lewis later in his life. He would appreciate more and more his Irish roots along the way. Belfast, of course, is Northern Ireland. It's Protestant Northern Ireland. We've been hearing a lot about Ireland lately, and now in the Republic of Ireland, Catholic Republic of Ireland, now it's legal to kill your baby in your womb. And what a great, great tragedy that is. His mother and father were bookish. He called his home a bookish home. They moved after he was when he was still a young boy to a place called Little Leah in Belfast, Ireland. His father was a solicitor. He was a lawyer. And there's a lot written about the different backgrounds, and their backgrounds are very different. You can trace Albert Lewis's background to Welsh, passionate Welsh poets from centuries before, and you can trace his mother's line, the Hamilton line, back to the Norman Conquest. They have a great relative buried at Abbey, Battle Abbey there in Hastings. But they were very different people, and they had very different reading tastes, and they were the kind of people that bought lots of books, and they kept all the books they bought. And they had, Lewis describes them having bookshelves that were deep, and they would have rows of books behind rows of books. And the parents were kind of hands-off sort of parents. It was sort of the way of things in those days. And as sort of nominal Anglicans, they were in the Church of Ireland, which is the Anglican Church in Ireland, and they were nominal. They went to church every Sunday. That's what nominal people did then, you know. Now nominal people go, you know, maybe at somebody's funeral or maybe a wedding. But in those days, nominal people went to church every week, but they didn't really come into their home life much at all. And Lewis and his older brother, 3 years older, he was born in 1895, Warren, were best buddies. And really throughout their life, it's a wonderful story in itself of siblings getting along. There's probably some siblings here that don't always get along. I had lunch with three siblings today. I won't ask for you to tell me about that, but my guess is that from time to time you don't get along all that well. Lewis and Warney, I'm sure they had their spats from time to time, but we just hear volumes of their appreciation of one another and the fun that they had together. They would read widely, you know, and Lewis says it probably was unwise for his parents to leave all those books from all those stages of their reading life out there for their boys to read whenever they felt like it. Lewis loved Beatrix Potter when he was younger, of course. Anybody know which one of Beatrix Potter's stories was his favorite? Mine's Peter Rabbit. That's the prototype of all, right? And by the way, who said that? Come on up here right now. You're going to finish this lecture. She's not obeying me. Whoa. I was going to take the mic off. No, I'm going to give you a book. Squirrel Nutkin. You know, Beatrix Potter's, you're welcome. Peter Rabbit is actually, it's actually the fall. Think about that. You can go back through the story. It's a short story, isn't it? But think back through it. But don't think about it right now. Let's pay attention. You do that on your own time. And he loved Edith Nesbit. Have you read Edith Nesbit? The Railway Children, The Would-Be Goods, a number of other, Enchanted Castle, a bunch of those. Debbie, good job. It's just Debbie and me to read Edith Nesbit, I guess. She was a piece of work, Edith Nesbit was. She was a communist. She was a Marxist. You know, she was really moving in an odd direction, but she was a very gifted writer. And Lewis appreciated her. He also liked A.A. Milne and was a great appreciator of him. And if you look at the timeline of A.A. Milne's writing, you're thinking, wait a second, that means that C.S. Lewis was reading A.A. Milne after World War I while he's at Oxford. What's he reading Winnie the Pooh then for? What's that about? You know? I mean, look at the timeline. That's when it would be. But Lewis was a great appreciator of good books, period. And he said a book wasn't worth reading at 10 that wasn't equally worth reading at 50. And I think that's a very helpful perspective for us. And he wrote Narnia not because he wanted to just communicate with children. This is dangerous. But because it was the best genre to communicate what he wanted and needed to communicate. And I think that's a very helpful thing. We kind of put things into too many categories there. Oh, I can't read that because, you know, I'm a, you know, intellectual and that's fiction or something. I hear that from time to time because I write primarily fiction. But, he and his brother created Boxen. Do you know something about that story? About when he was about 8 years old, they started writing plays, dramas, and Lewis would illustrate them, and they're around. I've got a copy of it at home. I couldn't bring it. It's a hardback copy. But fascinating stuff to see the development of Lewis's imagination and interest in literature and all. And one of the things that you find in Boxen is a whole lot more about politics. In fact, you could argue that he's hearing a lot of politics from his dad, who's a lawyer, and his mom discussing these things and all. But one of the things that you find about C.S. Lewis as he develops is he didn't like politics. He doesn't want to talk about politics. He didn't read the newspaper. Didn't like to listen to the radio, although he was on it a lot. You know, he figured that if something really important was going on in the world, there would be plenty of people telling him about it. He didn't need to waste his good reading time on reading the newspaper. Yeah, what does Mark Twain say? If you don't read the paper, I guess it'd be on your phone now, right? If you don't read the news, you're uninformed. If you do, you're misinformed. You know, so Lewis really lived out that understanding of things. Well, there was an interesting. I mentioned before that the mom and dad were kind of detached, and his dad especially was detached. But they had a succession of nannies throughout his growing up, governesses, if you will. And one of them, Lewis makes a point of talking about her in his spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy. And I love this part of his story. And on my final address, or actually second to final address, I want to try to make a connection here too, and we'll see if it's a valid one when we get there. But they had an Irish nanny. She was not particularly well educated at all. But she was, Lewis would say, a Presbyterian, and she really believed, he tells us. And her name was Annie Harper. And I just pause for a moment, young ladies in the room particularly, but young men as well. Annie Harper has this 8-year-old little, and he was kind of arrogant. I mean, he was really bright. You know, and of course, in the opening letter of Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis, many years later, would say that best of all in securing the soul for hell, for the devil, their father below, was to give him the grand general idea that he knows it all. And guess who Lewis is probably thinking of when he wrote that? Younger C.S. Lewis. I've read a lot of his letters from his younger days, and he was an arrogant little kid. You want to kick him in the teeth, you know? I mean, some of the letters he wrote back to his father and all. His father, this relationship was not good, and I'll try to tell you a little bit more about that as we go. But Annie Harper, be an Annie Harper. You know, there's little children around you in your home, younger siblings, in your churches. In the various at the grocery store, there's other families there that you don't even know, and there's little kids, and you're a big kid, you know, and they're looking up to you. Are you ignoring them? Are you taking those opportunities to plant seeds? Annie Harper planted the seeds of the gospel in young C.S. Lewis's life when he was 8, and he remembered it so well that he brings that back into his story of God's providence in saving his soul later. Well, when he is about 9 years old, his mother begins getting weaker and not feeling well and staying in bed longer, and he's worried, and Warnie's worried, and his dad's more and more detached because he's worried and he doesn't know what to do, and he works more, and they have nurses coming in, and eventually Lewis describes, and it's just a numbing description of a loved one dying in your home. In Surprised by Joy, he describes the footfalls in the hallway in the middle of the night, and the closing and opening doors, and the whispered voices in the hall, and he knew that his mother had passed away in the night. And it was a great grief to young C.S. Lewis, and as a good Anglican, he had been praying, maybe written out prayers, for his mother to recover from being sick. She just died. So almost 10-year-old C.S. Lewis makes a decision. It's important not to make cataclysmic ultimate decisions when you're 9 and a half, you know, or when you're 18 and a half, frankly, too. But Lewis made the decision that there's no God. I prayed to him, please heal my mother. My mother just died in the night. There is no God. And from that point on, Lewis kind of joined the ranks of the sort of the popular rationalist atheist of his day, especially in the academic world, as he would move on into that in the years ahead. But it was a great tragedy to him, and he felt really, really lost about this. His father didn't know what to do. His father was already pretty detached as a father. And in his own grief, he just withdrew even more. He didn't know how to give a big hug to his sons and weep with them. And so he just removed himself even more. To the extent that 2 weeks after his mother died, C.S. Lewis was put on a boat to England to go to a boarding school. And this begins C.S. Lewis's great hatred. I don't think that's too strong, actually. His great hatred of modern education, and especially of the English boarding school that he was in. He was in various boarding schools, and he would write letters weekly to his father, begging him to take him out of this purgatory, he called one of the schools, which was probably being nice about it. At one of the schools, after his father finally did remove him from the school, the headmaster of the school was diagnosed as being clinically insane and put in an asylum. Lewis had a rough time in these. He describes his education in those places, and it is not a good description. It's not the fun part of Surprised by Joy. It really is not. But he is a voracious reader, and he has been since he could first learn to read, and he had all these books, and he has, I wouldn't go so far as to say he's a photographic memory, but he had categories for so many of the things that he read, and he was able to keep them in their categories. Brilliant, brilliant mind. And I envy people with minds like that so much. His dad was so detached that, and I'm going to jump ahead for here for a moment, that when it was time for C.S. Lewis to be called up for World War I, and he's going to be shipped to France. And, you know, the news reports have been coming in for quite some time. This is 1917. They'd had 3 years of this. They thought the thing was going to be over before Christmas in 1914, and it wasn't. And his father didn't even return the telegram and didn't come to see his son off. Lewis would be wounded in World War I. Again, more of this tomorrow. But he'd be wounded in World War I, and he'd be in a field hospital, and then he'd be in the Salisbury Plain in a hot London, and then the Salisbury Plain for months of recuperation. And his father never took the boat across from Belfast to come see his son in that recuperation time. So it was a strained and difficult relationship. At one point, Lewis's father was insistent that he be confirmed in the Anglican Church, the Church of Ireland. And this is when he's about 14 or so. And so he goes through the confirmation classes in the Anglican Church, and he tells us that he went and communed for the first time at St. Mark's in Belfast. He went and communed for the first time on December 4th, 1914. Think about that. The war is just, we're just like 3-4 months into the war, World War I. And, he says, he put it this way, he said that I went and I ate and drank condemnation to myself, not believing a word of it. So by 14, he was an intractable atheist, so he thought. But he fulfilled his father's wishes. He told a friend of his in a letter that Arthur Greaves was his main correspondent, tons of letters back and forth, a neighbor across the street from little Leah in Belfast. He told him that it was the worst decision he ever made in his life to commune without believing any of it. Well, all those schools that he's going to, and things are not going very well. And eventually he begs his father to put him to a private tutor. And Albert Lewis had been tutored by William Kirkpatrick in Surrey, England. And he was a Scots Presbyterian, but completely atheist and not interested in that. And the tipping of the hat to his Scots Presbyterian roots was that the rest of the week he would, you know, wear sort of regular clothes, and then on Sunday he would wear his best suit and his best collar and tie, and then go out in the garden and work and puddle around in the garden on Sunday. Didn't go to church, but this habit was sticking pretty hard. But he was a brilliant tutor, and Lewis was there for 3 years, and it was a real defining time. But you're thinking, wait a second, the guy's an atheist. How's that going to help Lewis? There's great ironies in this, and Lewis would point them out later, that Kirkpatrick, they called him the Great Knock. He was tough. I mean, he was tough, and it was one-on-one. You couldn't hide. You couldn't say, could you ask somebody else to read their essay? Hey, there is no somebody else. You're it. He was rigorous that whatever assertion you made, you had to back that up with solid evidence and then show how that evidence backs up your thesis statement. That's basic essay writing, by the way, there, and it's a skill that you should be mastering. You should be writing an essay on your own, by your own initiative, on the things that you've read or the things you're hearing, and make a truth statement. You know, in my state, they started a bunch of new initiatives in education, and it was that at 10th grade you had to take an essay and see if you're meeting all the benchmarks and all, and then your senior year. Well, the deal was it was a complete failure. You know, but the starting point of the whole new curriculum was that we're going to give multicultural texts to the students. We're not going to give great books. We're not going to do Shakespeare. We're not going to do the dead white males. None of that stuff. And we don't believe, we believe in moral relativism, but we expect them to be able to write an essay where they make a truth statement and then they defend it with solid evidence and draw inevitable conclusions from that evidence. Well, of course they can't do that, right? Because we've removed the organ. They can't do the function any longer. Mrs. Kirkpatrick took C.S. Lewis to, they got off at Charing Cross in London, and they went in at that time, and there's still some there today, but they went for a walk along all of these bookshops all along the street there. And Lewis stumbled across, right? Lewis would grow in his sense of the providence and sovereignty of God in every detail, in the minutiae of life. And we'll get to that later in the week. But he comes across a copy of George MacDonald's Phantastes. And he reads George MacDonald. How many of you read George MacDonald? The Princess and Curdy, The Princess and the Goblin, some of those. I'm just finishing The Princess and the Goblin with Julian right now. I didn't get it quite done before we left. But George MacDonald, C.S. Lewis would say, baptized his imagination. And George MacDonald was a Church of Scotland minister at the time and was writing lots of fiction, sort of fantasy as well. And Lewis would say that in all of his fiction works, he owed a debt to George MacDonald along the way. And this happens right here. And there were various experiences that C.S. Lewis had in his life along the way that were shaping him and helping to expose the God-size hole that was in his heart and that needed to be seen and known. One of them, and I was going to read something, but I just checked the time, and I'm not going to. But one of them was his brother came in one day back when they were boys, and he had taken a big biscuit tin, you know, a cookie tin, like you'd get at Christmas, a Danish cookie tin or something. He'd taken the lid of the thing, and he'd taken moss and rocks and sticks, and he'd made some trees and, you know, a little fort here and all that, and he came and he just gave it to his little brother. And Lewis describes these things as almost like a catharsis. There was just this concentration of emotional wonder that happened about this other world that he could see in microcosm on this biscuit tin, you know, lid. And various other things, reading poetry of Longfellow, and a phrase jumps out at him, and it, you know, you read the phrase and it seems like, how is that going to move him? But there were these concentrations, and Lewis came to call it a couple of things. Even as a boy, a young man, he called it northernness, or joy with a capital J. He was longing for something, and it wasn't being fulfilled by the ordinary stuff of his life. And this, again, was the beginning workings of the Spirit of God in C.S. Lewis's heart. Sort of unmasking how inadequate things are and people are to fill the God-sized hole in our being. Well, after 3 years with Kirkpatrick, he's Oxford bound. That's where he wants to go. He wants to go to Oxford. And he goes to Oxford in 1916 to sit for the entrance exams for Oxford. And these are rigorous. They're rigorous today. But they were rigorous then. And long story short, on the parts that had to do with language and literature, books, C.S. Lewis was off the charts. On the part that had to do with math, this is one of the things I love about C.S. Lewis, he was a math moron. I mean, the guy, he had all kinds of number problems. And he flunked the first round of the math exam. But you're sitting, it's University College, which was the founding college back in the early 1200s of Oxford. There's some argument about that. St. Edmund's Hall says, well, we were there first. You know, Merton says, we were there first. But anyway, that's probably University College. The problem was is that the halls were empty. You know, the tutorials were almost empty. 1916? I'm not giving a book away for this. I mean, you guys can do the math. Why are the halls empty? They're over there dying in the trenches of the Western Front. And so they needed students, right? So here you go, C.S. Lewis, probably, you know, arguably the greatest Christian apologist of the 20th century, one of the greatest authors of the 20th century, only got into Oxford because they were making some special deals, fudging it for dummies that didn't know their math, you know. And that would reoccur after the war. I'm going to skip the whole war thing because there's enough material there. I want to really talk about that and concentrate on that because it's a real defining moment for Lewis. The Oxford system was a tutorial system. Mentioned the trivium before. This is classical learning, the revival of learning. You know, the Renaissance gets way too much credit. This was a big deal for C.S. Lewis. He didn't really believe that there was a Renaissance. The medievalism was doing fine on its own, Lewis believed. And really, the revival of learning and scholarship happened before the Renaissance, really. and it was the discovery or rediscovery of classical learning, the trivium, the quadrivium, and the stages of development of learning. You know, the grammar stage, the logic stage, the rhetoric stage, and that's what you did at Oxford, particularly the rhetoric stage. They did it all in tutorial. It's still a tutorial university today. So you have this wonderful ratio, the ideal ratio for the student of professor to student, tutor to student. And Lewis would excel, in fact, completed his degree in classics in a very short period of time and also did another degree in philosophy. We'll talk more about some of those things a bit later. I'm going to skip on ahead. But there was a defining moment for C.S. Lewis after the war, and he's back there. He's resumed his studies. Many of his friends are dead. J.R.R. Tolkien would say that at the end of the war, because Tolkien was in the war as well, wasn't wounded. He got very sick. He got trench fever and had to be taken back to England to recover. And the war was over by the time he was recovered. But Tolkien said by the end of the war, only one of his friends was alive. Only one friend was alive. And Lewis could say much the same thing. One of his friends was Paddy Moore. They had shared a carpetless little cell at Keble College. Keble College was turned into the officer training center for that region of England. So Lewis moves from his rooms at University College. He'd only been there since April, and he moves to those rooms in the, I think, August. You know, so I mean, he's barely an Oxford student, and plus he flunked the math part. I don't want to jump too much ahead, but his father wanted him to go in the artillery because he thought that would be a safer thing for him than being out there in the trenches in the mud, you know, over the top, getting shot, mowed down by machine gun fire. The problem was C.S. Lewis couldn't get into the artillery because he had to be able to do some trigonometry to be in the artillery, you know. Well, let's see, speed, you know, he couldn't do any of that. So he's saying, Dad, sorry about that. I'm too much of a meathead with math to do that. Well, we'll move ahead to May 29th, 1921, and Lewis had entered a contest. By this time, he's completed his classics degree, and he's, you know, he got firsts. And in their system, that means you're the top of the pile. You know, and there was an essay contest, and these were frequent at Oxford. They're sort of the most concentrated genre of writing for testing your ability to think. I'm a big fan of you learning to write essays and being able to give an answer to those who ask you the reason of the hope that's within you with meekness and fear. The essay is your place to practice that. Make a truth statement. Jesus is the Son of God. And then support that statement with solid evidence and then draw your conclusion showing how that supports that statement. That's a very critical part of clear thinking. And the nice thing about writing is it slows the process down. It enables you to slow down, to think it through, to mull it over, to read some more, to gain some more perspective, to get some more enlargement of who you are. So if you get, should I say this? If you get one of five things from me this week, the one I hope you get, one of the five, is start writing essays. I'm going to call all your parents, tell them, don't let them do anything they want to do. No pizza till you write the essay. Alright. Well, Paddy Moore, who he had shared the cell with, they made a pact with one another. Each of them had a single parent. Paddy Moore had his mother, Mrs. Moore, and his sister, Maureen, and Lewis had Albert and Warney. They made an agreement that if something happened in the war, which is entirely likely, given the statistics of World War I, that the other one would take care of the other's parent. They never even found so much as a tooth from Paddy Moore. That was about 40% of the casualties, the death in World War I. If you go to Thiepval in the Western Front, you'll see a monument to almost 73,000 British soldiers who they never found anything to bury. They were gone, obliterated by bombardment and so forth. March 24th, 1918, there was a report about Paddy Moore, and he was a second lieutenant. The highest casualty office of World War I was the junior officer, first guy over the trench with the whistle in his mouth and his Webley revolver in his hand, going up against machine gun fire and artillery. They really wore out those. There were some platoons that were being led by privates at various sectors in the Western Front, simply because there was no officer in the neighborhood, not even a non-commissioned officer to take care of that. Well, so when he comes back from the war, heals from his wounds, we'll talk more about that tomorrow, he keeps his promise. He looks up Mrs. Moore, who came to visit him in the hospital when his own dad didn't. And there's kind of a strain that happens for years, because his father feels like Lewis sees Mrs. Moore as more of a mother than he's a parent than he sees his own father. And there was good reason for that. She was there when he was. And eventually, long story short, Lewis is trying to get a job at Oxford. After, you know, he's a scholar. You know, what do you do as a scholar? Well, you teach at your alma mater, or else, you know, you're going to mop floors somewhere or something like that, which is a very honorable calling. We need clean floors. But Lewis was trying to get a job. There weren't a lot of openings. And eventually he gets a one-year short-term fill-in for a professor who's on a sabbatical at University College. Tries to get some more jobs, but barely enough money to work on to live on his father sending him funds. And eventually he gets made a tutor. In 1925, he is made a tutor at Magdalen College, Oxford. And for the next 30 years, he would be there at Magdalen College, Oxford. A tutor is in the tutorial system of university, unlike what we have, sits down with 2, 3, maybe 5, but, you know, usually a smaller number, sometimes just one-on-one students, and you assign them readings, and then 2 days later they come back and they've read those things and they have an essay. Did I mention essays already? Yeah, I think I did. They have an essay that they've carefully crafted, and they presented it. They're to present it to their professor, and he is going to critique it, and you're going to spend several hours together working through all of that. Well, they eventually buy the kilns over those years, and Mrs. Moore lives there with Maureen, and it's an odd relationship, and I think it's made more odd by some of the biographers and all than it actually was, in my opinion. But she was she read no books. Warney says that he never saw her with a book in hand the whole time he was there. Warney wasn't real happy about this pact that his brother had made with Paddy Moore and being stuck with them. But she did help pay for the house and all, so that was a good thing. But it was an awkward situation. She was kind of cranky. She was domineering. When Lewis would come home from being a, you know, Oxford don sort of thing, she would put him to work. You know, the toilet's not working. Would you fix that? You know? And so he would be, or he'd be painting something, or he'd be, you know, shoveling something out in the garden. She had all these little jobs, and Warney felt like those jobs were sort of intended to annoy and aggravate Lewis. But interestingly, it's almost like Lewis had, you know, survivor guilt or something from World War I. I don't know about these phenomenon, but that this was his duty to his good friend Paddy Moore to care for his mother, and his mother was not easy to care for, and especially as she got into some dementia later on. But we lunge ahead in the story. The thing I want to really get to here, there it is. In the next few minutes before we close, is Lewis begins to question some of his basic assumptions. By 1929, the rigorous instruction that he had from the great Nock, from Kirkpatrick, the atheist, but that required him to make truth statements and support them with solid evidence, it also reversed itself, and he could take a look at basic assumptions of society like rationalist naturalism around him, and he began to say, it's founded on fallacious arguments. There's not solid evidence to support this. And as he began to be kind of inadvertently He didn't really want to be. It was very unpopular to critique the growing postmodernism that was happening at the leading edge of that in his day. You were supposed to lockstep with naturalist atheism if you were going to be thought well of at Oxford. He would be passed over for full professorships multiple times at Magdalen College for several reasons. He wrote for children. That was beneath the dignity of an intellectual to write books for children, you know? And he was an outspoken Christian as time would go on. But that jumps ahead of the story. At this point, he's beginning to critique those basic assumptions, and his atheism is starting to go away. And guess what did it? Books. Reading. He tells us that if you wish to remain a sound atheist, a young man can't be too careful of his reading. And he lists some of the ones he was reading, and some of these might surprise you, but he lists John Milton. Remember, he loves English classic literature. John Milton, Geoffrey Chaucer, Edmund Spencer. I don't know if you've read Edmund Spencer. Lewis says that to read Edmund Spencer is to grow in mental health. He's quite a gifted writer. And he lists Shakespeare as a Christian writer. Now, we don't know his heart and all, but I think what Lewis was talking about was the basic assumptions informing this author. Their sense of ultimate things, their sense of moral right and wrong, is a Christian sense of those things. And Chesterton, he's in the trenches in World War I, and some of his friends are sending him books. He's crying every time he writes a letter. He says, send me more books. You know, we have all this boredom time, and then this sheer terror as we go over the top. And during the boredom time, I'd like to keep reading. So someone sent him the essays of G.K. Chesterton. And Chesterton has his problems, but again, Chesterton's one of those guys that when he gets it right, he really, really, really gets it right. And he articulates it in a way. And so Lewis is reading him, and it's beginning to have its work on him. While he's recovering in the Salisbury Plain, in the convalescent hospital there for soldiers, someone gives him Chesterton's The Everlasting Man. You ever read The Everlasting Man? It is a Augustinian historiography. I talked about historiography 5 years ago when I was here. I don't know if any of you are here that were here 5 years ago, maybe a few of you. But it's an argument for a Christian view, a providential view of causality in history. And here's this young atheist just wounded in World War I, and he's reading The Everlasting Man. So these things were working away on him, and looking back, he says, I should have been more careful of my reading if I wanted to remain a sound atheist. So at this point, he's coming to the place where he has to abandon his belief in his atheism, rationalism. And it's troubling to him. He used to say, had God designed the world, it would not be a world so frail and faulty as we see. But then Kirkpatrick kicks in and he's saying, okay, I just made an assertion, but I need to define the terms in my assertion, something you should learn to do really well in your essay writing. Frail, faulty? Compared to what? How do I even know how to use those two terms? If I'm a rationalist atheist, amoral rationalist atheist, how can something be faulty? How can it be frail? How could it be strong? You know, how could it be true? How could it be false? And so he begins to realize that he's using terminology that has to be borrowed from somewhere, and he's not sure where, and he's not sure he likes where he thinks it's coming from. And he's increasingly being more and more informed by these Christian authors. He would go on to read many others. He says this, listen to this, because it gives us a little window into his rooms at Magdalen College. He's in the new rooms, they call it, at Magdalen College, Oxford. They were finished, I think, in 1711. That's new in Oxford, by the way, just so you know. He says this, you must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted, even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet, that which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in England. Now, if a guy is drowning in the sea, right? And they're going under. and a boat comes along, a Coast Guard comes along, and they grab the guy by the hair, and they pull him up out of drowning in the sea. Is he a reluctant convert? Is he reluctantly, hey, leave me alone! I'm having fun here! Did you say that? No? But when you come to a new intellectual understanding, I think that what Lewis is talking about right here is at least largely an intellectual understanding. He's here abandoned his youthful atheism because it doesn't bear up under the rigors of logic and clear rational thinking. He couldn't argue it intellectually anymore. A good scholar, Anthony Flew, many years, more recently, he used to be the Richard Dawkins of Lewis's day. He was the atheist of Lewis's day, debated in the Socratic Club. He said, I've been trained to follow the evidence wherever it leads, and the evidence does not lead to naturalist atheism. It leads to deism or something like that, thought Anthony Flew. But that's where Lewis was here, and I believe at this point Lewis is a reluctant convert to intellectual theism. He knows it's going to cost him, and it did at Magdalen College. All those lost opportunities to have a full professorship. I don't think anybody is converted to Christ, rescued from their sins, from a certain death and hell, reluctantly. Once you see the light, you revel in the light, and you do as C.S. Lewis does so well in his writing. Lewis makes goodness. It's hard to do this with your pen. It's much easier to draw antagonists, monstrous characters and all of that. Evil, so much easier to portray in writing. But Lewis makes goodness thrilling, and he makes it radiant and tangible in his writing. And it's a remarkable gift that he had. But then he moves from there, and with this we will close. And it goes back to a night, September 19th, 1931. And as these men did, again, most of them were single. Tolkien wasn't, but most of them were single dons. They were Oxford. They were sort of married to Oxford University and to their role as academics there. But he and Hugo Dyson, a Protestant, earnest Christian, and Tolkien, went out to Addison's Walk. Joseph Addison started The Spectator back in 1711 with Richard Steele, and he was a son of Oxford and of Magdalen College, and he used to go over to this little island in the Cherwell River. You crossed a little bridge. I was just walking around it a month and a half ago. Again, I love that place, and they walked around it all night, and they were talking about myth. And Lewis was fascinated. He had a high view of classical myth, the Greeks, the Romans, eventually Icelandic myth, and all of these things. He loved myths, and in them he found something that felt like it was about to fill that God-sized hole in his being, but it never quite did. And the argument that both Dyson and Tolkien made is that you already have a high view of heroes, champions that sacrifice themselves for the good of the whole civilization, and that thrills your soul. You know, there's you're positioned to embrace Christianity because Jesus is the ultimate redeemer who sacrifices himself for his people, and the difference between those myths and the Christian myth is that it's really true. It actually happened. It's historically verifiable. It's real. And those other stories are just human efforts to try and fill the God-sized hole and try and find and fulfill this, or at least express this longing for the Redeemer, the King of Kings. Lewis didn't fall on his knees and call Christ Lord and God that night, but he tells us a few days later, Lewis loved animals, do I need to even say that? And the idea of talking animals is full in his Boxen series when he was a boy. But he loved to go to the zoo, Whitsnade Zoo in England, if you go to where John Newton wrote Amazing Grace. And you go, let me think here, east a ways, you'll get to Whitsnade Zoo. Brits in the room, you can correct me there, but Whitstable, it was a little ways away in those days, the roads, they didn't have motorways and stuff, and Lewis got in a sidecar. Lewis never learned to drive a car, never learned to type with a typewriter. We'll talk more about why later. There was a very, very intentional reason why, but he gets in the sidecar, puts on the goggles, you know, the leather helmet thing, and Warren, he loved motorcycles, and they roar off to the Whitstable Zoo. It was about a two-hour drive in those days. And Lewis says that when he got in the sidecar, he didn't believe that Jesus Christ was the Son. He was a theist at this time. He'd been a theist for about a year and a half. but he didn't believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. When they pulled into the parking lot at the Whitstable Zoo, and Warney put the brakes on, Lewis said he believed that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. And not only just the Son of God out there, but that he was his Savior. And he fell at the feet of Jesus and called him Lord and God. So much more to say, but I see my time is finished, so let's put that on hold, and we'll pick up more tomorrow. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for the wonder of your providence. We thank you for the hound of heaven, that your Holy Spirit, when the Father has set his electing love on the heart of someone, the life of someone like C.S. Lewis or any one of us in this room, from before the foundation of the world, and Jesus has come and fully paid for all of their sins with his precious blood, and set them free from the tyranny of the devil, and he has imputed his righteousness to their account. And then the Holy Spirit begins to work in all the mysterious and wonderful ways that the Spirit works. Even through an atheist that's trying to keep C.S. Lewis firmly in the atheist camp. What a wonder it is to see the salvation of a sinner. And it gives us hope, and we do pray, Father, that you would help us to be hopeful people as we step out from this conference in a few days and go back to our homes and our neighbors, unbelievers in our neighborhoods that we see around, and we may have given up on them. Relatives that are unbelievers, and we've given up on them long ago because we are not thinking monergistically. We're not thinking that God saves sinners, that salvation is of the Lord. We thank you that you rescued C.S. Lewis and that you equipped him and that he used his gifts for your glory. Help his gifts to shape ours and to prepare us for lives of joyful service for your kingdom's sake, and to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, and with gentleness and respect to give an answer to everyone who asks us the reason of the hope that's in us. And in all of that, to honor Christ the Lord as holy. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.